Welcome back to Daily Discoveries. It is week 5, and today we're going to be discussing a little bit about school reopenings and job impacts as a result of COVID. But, before we get into that, I kind of wanted to know, how are you doing week 5 of winter quarter?
I'm really tired, but I'm hanging in there. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, pretty much the same, you know, it's just kind of like a lot to handle, and I think like winter quarter is always one of the most difficult quarters, even in pre-COVID times, because, you know, like maybe you have a class where you're ending and it's dark out, and now as we're recording this, it's like 4:45 and it's already getting dark for me. I don't know about you, but like it's just kind of a weird disconnect, and having so little light during the day makes you really unmotivated. So I think it's even harder online.
I definitely understand. Actually, it's funny she mentioned that. I actually put it into my try to do every day in the week list to try and get a little bit of fresh air every day, because I realized that with the really short sunlight window and with just like the aspect of being indoors all day because of COVID, that like I'm not actually seeing sunlight very much at all, and I'm trying to improve that. So if you feel like that's the same thing, I would really encourage you to just like get like 10 or 15 minutes, because I feel like it's made a huge difference in my mood.
Yeah, no, I totally know what you mean, and I also feel like I'm just like condensing all of my daily activities into like this really weird light time schedule. Like I find myself like eating dinner at like 6 or 5:50, which is kind of bizarre to think about, because it's as soon as it's like dark out, I basically don't want to do any work, so I'm like, well, might as well push on with my evening. So it's really odd to deal with, but yeah, I am Thelonious Gertz, and I'm a senior.
I'm Rhea John, and I'm a senior too.
And you're listening to Daily Discoveries. And so, you know, we've kind of been chatting about the pandemic for the last like 6 months or so. It's usually come up at least a couple times per episode, or, you know, maybe we've had full episodes dedicated to it. But today we're going to be kind of discussing some of the discourse that's been happening around schools. And, you know, as you might have read or seen, there's this kind of prevailing rhetoric around like opening schools and like getting kids back into the classroom, and people have been citing kind of vague ideas about the drawbacks of not having kids in the classroom and not allowing them to get that kind of like normal part of development. So we kind of wanted to dig into that a little bit more and talk about that. So, you know, firstly, I would just say, like, what have you been hearing in your tertiary reading and whatever?
Well, I've been hearing kind of conflicting things, I guess. It's interesting because it's hard to even think about it this way, but since we're starting February, we're almost at a year since like this pandemic business really started taking off, and we stopped being in school, and like my siblings stopped being in school and all that. And the interesting thing is that even though science like moves really fast and data moves really fast a lot of the time, this is one of those cases where we look at and get to talk about how slow science and data can also be sometimes. Almost a year in, one of the reasons why there's so much conflict in a lot of the reading I'm doing, and also in a lot of the things that I'm hearing in my immediate circle, because my brothers are school aged and they've been kind of teasing the idea of maybe going back to school like a couple of times and then withdrawing it already. It's that a lot of people really want to get kids back in school for a variety of reasons, which we can get more into later in the episode. But there just isn't any actual solid data about it at all. So some places in the country already have gotten a head start on starting to do that. Some places in the country are not doing that. Some places have started and tried rolling it back. And that's not just in America, but also around the world. And even though that's been occurring and people are in different places, we can't really ascertain for sure from any concrete numbers how cases are affected in those places, whether it's safe in general, and we can't really make many sweeping generalizations about when everyone will get to go back to school safely.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point, is that, like, there are some fundamental questions, like, is school reopening safe, which could be kind of up for debate, because no matter what you're doing right now, if you're not vaccinated, your COVID risk in terms of you getting it and spreading it is, it's never going to be non-zero, let's put it that way. And so I think, like, the idea of balancing trade-offs is one that is a fundamentally subjective opinion. And so there's this editorial in that the Bloomberg School of Public Health put out recently, where they say that, like, there basically is all this discourse about, like, schools are, like, kind of okay to open, and it's really kind of hesitant, but there's this prevailing rhetoric from a variety of different scientists that schools can open safely if they follow a certain amount of measures, such as creating pods and having kids only come in on certain different days, kind of like in waves. And one of the things that they're kind of resting on is they're resting on some pretty inconclusive data about, like, whether it would be safe. And they're also resting on the opinion of the lawmaker who says, like, okay, we're going to go, we're going to do that. And so I think, like, that is kind of what it comes down to. Like, there's no empirical evidence that says this is 100% safe or this is, like, so much safer. One thing we can say is that, like, it's a little bit safer than dining, because, like, if you're dining or, you know, doing something which requires you to take off your mask, that increases risk because you don't have anything covering the droplet particles that come out of your mouth. So that's one thing. But I also think it just kind of speaks to this larger issue of, like, we don't really have conclusive data, and the conclusive data to get it would be, it would come at a high cost, essentially. You know, just saying, like, let's try it and see what happens is not usually a good idea. And if we were to do that, basically the cost of getting the data would just be very high.
One of the challenging things about it, too, I think, is that even in some of the places that we could look to as maybe a model of, oh, look, they've started this thing, let's see if it works for them or not, is that especially when we think about it on a global scale, the actual level of restrictions on daily life can vary dramatically. So one of the places that I saw referenced in online articles about this kind of loosely talked about some general ideas of transmission that they had gotten from schools in Europe that were, like, or in overseas like that were trying some reintroduction methods, and they had mentioned really low transmission rates. But as we know, in Europe and abroad, in those in that set of countries, the actual everyday life restrictions are also much more strict than they are for us in America. And even in America, it can depend state to state, you know, depending on what your governor or even what, like, the local attitudes of people around you might be, how much exposure and how much like daily going out and interacting with people might be considered commonplace. So it can be really hard to compare.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to bring up too, because, like, you know, there's, whether we like it or not, there are different trajectories that different states have been on. And like you said, some of them are drastically different. There's also been, like, certain states in which the virus has been, like, reasonably contained just by virtue of it being very small. For example, Vermont is a really tiny state, and so they've been able to do a pretty decent job. And some states have just taken it more seriously. And I mean, I don't want to, like, obviously we're not talking about politics specifically, but there is a clear political divide in how the virus has been carried out, and so you see many Republican and Southern states doing worse off, although that's not mutually exclusive, because, you know, California is a very blue state, but it's also doing very badly virus-wise. So those do also make a difference. And so I think, like, one of the things we're seeing is that, like, there is no one decision that is going to be, like, perfect for this type of deal. But the thing that I think is kind of good to know is that, like, they are actively discussing alternatives to figure out how to do this safely, which may become an idea in the near future. And the Biden administration is also pushing to have schools reopen to some degree in 100 days. And the focus has kind of mostly been on kids in, like, elementary to high school. So yeah, do you want to like summarize some of the general like implications of like why people would be pushing for in-person school after so long?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. So one of the main reasons that people are so focused on getting kids back into school, at least like to start with, we can talk about for the perspective of like why it's important for children directly, is that especially from like the viewpoint of pediatricians, it's that schools have a lot to offer for students in the sense of like their socialization, especially. So in terms of like maintaining good mental health in children and proper socialization in youth, it's really important. And then it's also important because, okay, so there's like a pediatrician in an article that I read who was basically quoted as talking about some of the issues that she sees most commonly being issues with hunger and then obesity due to inactivity, and also like concerns around child abuse, which, to be clear, like those things kind of occur not because the implication there isn't that like child abuse is more likely to occur because children are staying at home. It's more that in schools, that's like one of the societal contact points where people outside of the home can view a child and like ensure welfare. So it's really a concern that when children aren't being brought to school, that there's no one to see them to make sure that they're not falling victim to child abuse or that someone in their home is not harming them. And then, you know, there's also a concern over reduced routine medical visits, just because there's not everyone necessarily has access to the same level of healthcare. And in schools, you know, with the employment of like school nurses, there's like some general standard level to which everyone can expect generalized care, obviously not very specific care like visiting a physician, but at least someone's like keeping an eye on children in that way for significant problems. And then with hunger, I think obesity is pretty like understandable in terms of children don't have a lot of opportunities right now to get out of the house and play the way they would usually. But the hunger thing is a little bit different. It's more about how for some students, especially like depending on whether they're from areas that fall lower on like a socioeconomic scale, school can be their primary source of meals. So when children aren't able to come into school, they also may not be eating regularly the way they would be when lunches are provided to them by the school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that and those are all very important things, and it becomes really hard to decide like what are you going to do, because you have, on one hand, you have all these social equity issues, which are the result of not having a robust welfare system, which, you know, is just, that's a problem that's not even pandemic related, but the pandemic just makes it all the more obvious. But then you also have to decide, like, okay, you're stuck between child endangerment and basically child endangerment on the other side. So it's like, which child endangerment do you choose? And I mean, it's not a simple equation to kind of figure out. Even if you did have data that said really, really highly, like, oh, you know, well, this is, you know, can be done safely. So it's not a clear decision.
I think that a lot of people were also kind of assuming for a while here that I think generally and colloquially that, you know, once there is kind of a vaccine solution, then it's going to be so much safer, then we don't have to worry about things, you know, children going back to school will happen really naturally. And obviously getting the COVID vaccine to be distributable is a huge plus and really important. But also, I think that people are kind of seeing now that it's not necessarily as simple as there being a vaccine on the market and available, especially in terms of school reopening, because I saw the King County post this thing talking generally in Washington State about how there were over 300,000 requests for the first dose of the vaccine to be delivered, and Washington State was only like received about half of that in terms of first doses. So we can kind of see that there is this difference in like the actual need to receive doses and then the actual ability to distribute doses. And that's true in Washington, but also in many other states. So it's not really like the kind of fast catch-all solution for going back to school.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally true. And a lot of this is suffering from a time delay. And like, honestly, if we manage to get vaccines under control very quickly, then we could make rapid progression and we'd be in a much safer place. But it's also like there's infrastructure issues that just can't be helped anytime soon. And there's also issues of distribution. I recently read that the U.S. had purchased 200 million vaccines, which is like a little bit under 2/3 of the U.S. population, which means that, you know, you could, generally speaking, reach herd immunity combined to the, with the amount of vaccines that we've already done in record time. But the problem is that storing those vaccines and distributing them and having people give them out and do it safely is like such an obstacle. So there's like huge supply chain issues too.
For sure. I think that one of the things we should also just kind of touch on, just in case anyone's like unclear about it too, is that one of the things that I've seen like online generally with people like speculating about school reopenings is sort of the idea that like, yes, infection is like a possible risk of school reopenings, but at the same time, like children aren't particularly susceptible, perhaps, has been like kind of thrown around, to which actually like what the data kind of shows us is more that it's correct that like children tend to not develop the most severe symptoms of coronavirus exposure. They tend to have like much milder symptoms, much milder cases, and are much more often asymptomatic compared to like older people or adults who actually contract it. But that being said, besides the fact that like tend to is not universal, so there are still going to be some people that contract severe cases in their youth. The other thing about it is that they've also kind of posed that they currently believe or estimate that children actually like are asymptomatic carriers of coronavirus for a bit longer than exposed adults. And the issue about that is not about directly like children necessarily like being ill, but also the, I mean, that is part of the concern, but also part of the concern is the extended like stress on the healthcare system. If you imagine that like children are like carrying this around for longer and could transmit it to other people, even if they themselves are not the most sick members of the population, it kind of increases the number of sick adults or older people who will then, you know, need hospitalization and treatment. And I think we've seen, especially in like places like LA, but all over the country, how stressed the healthcare system already is, the shortage of beds everywhere, and like the overworking of healthcare workers. So that's also a major concern with the reopening issue.
Yeah, I think bringing up the transmission and all of that is actually really important, because I think like transmitting is just as important as getting it, and that can just make it worse and worse and worse if you're not careful. In addition to that, we're also going to talk about job prospects and kind of some of the effects on the economy. And I know you had some interesting statistics and whatnot to chat about.
Yeah, I'm actually so excited we're getting into this. I saw something that this statistic I thought was totally stunning, because when do you ever see a 100% statistic? You know, when my friend told me about this, me and her also like used to take stats together, and she said 100% of women, and I was like, no, hold on, like we take stats together, it can't be 100%, you must mean like 99, like really close to 100. But actually it actually is 100, so I think that's kind of unique. And the stat that I'm talking about is about job losses in December. So basically what happened is that of the job losses in December, women accounted for 100% of them, because women like as a group as a whole lost 156,000 jobs, and then like men gained 16,000. So the net loss was like entirely by women, which is really surprising. And that's not to say that men also lost jobs in December, but when we consider the group as a whole, that's kind of what it comes out to, which was very unique. It's actually especially unique because, so 2020's been a terrible year for jobs in general, but it's also been one of the worst years for jobs for women. The women ended 2020 with like about 5 million fewer jobs in February, which is compared to about like 4.5 million jobs for men over that same period. So it's one of the most like terrible times for women's employment that we've seen in a really long time, which is kind of unique, and also just kind of like ties into a lot of social things in general, at least about like childcare and women in the workforce. One of the things that we've seen a lot, which is also relevant to school closures, is that with children in the home, childcare and work have also changed a lot, and a lot of women are actually leaving the workforce to provide childcare at home, which has been a really interesting trend as of late. But what I thought was especially interesting about these statistics too, because I know that before the article, or before this episode started recording, you and I were talking a little bit, you were telling me a little bit about like disproportionalities in terms of race and illness and like other types of risk related to these issues. And like the gender disparity is even like really amplified by a race disparity when it comes to jobs for women. So especially because one of the industries we saw hit the hardest with the pandemic was the service industry. One of the things the CNN Business talks about is how Black women and Latino women lost the most jobs in December, with white women actually making gains, like as a total group. Yeah. And then also that in general, over the course of the pandemic, that Black and Latino women have taken some of the hardest hits in terms of job losses, because a lot of Black and Latino women actually like comprise jobs in the service industry. And so when those jobs take a hit, these women especially see their job prospects change a lot and their job holdings lowered as well.
Yeah. Was this globally or nationally?
This is nationally.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting. And I think we should definitely delve deeper into this, like how this happens in another episode. But at least one of the things that becomes really clear is that like that overwhelming bias to allocate childcare responsibilities to women in relationships is probably at least what I think is the most like likely mechanism here. And because it just so happens that the world is now like in need of constant childcare, that type of thing happens. And I'm kind of disappointed to see that, you know, men haven't stepped up, because, you know, really with, if you're a family and you're resigned to the home, like why should it be one gender's job over the other?
You know, I would actually suggest that I do 100% agree with that point, but I would actually suggest that maybe we should look into a little bit more data on this as well, just because I would actually kind of wager, I guess, that it's probably also partially due to the fact that I'm guessing that in a lot of houses, and don't hate me for this, okay, it's not bad feminism, I'm just talking facts here. I have a feeling that in the majority of American households, I'm guessing that men are primary breadwinners and that they earn higher salaries than women in the household. So I think that could also be a major contributor. Not that like, you know, gender stereotypes aren't in play, I'm sure they might also be, but I think it's also because of earning differences between genders as well that really influences us.
It could very well be both, as well as a lot of, it's probably more, you know, it probably is more complicated, and there's probably a lot of factors, but yeah, it's just, it is, it's sometimes, and this is not a super sophisticated statement, but it's just sometimes very shocking how durable these, like, social mechanisms are. Whether they're right or wrong, you look at them over time, and it's, like, really, really shocking, like, how pervasive they are, and obviously we're, you know, seeing that now in a variety of ways.
For sure. I also thought it was really interesting to read about. I would really encourage, like, especially if anyone listening is particularly interested in this topic, to look into some of the research that exists currently about racial and ethnic disparities when it comes to paid family and medical leave, because it's kind of been established pretty well across some different papers and in some interesting reviews as well, that people of color less frequently have access to paid family and medical leave and their jobs, which I'm sure also contributes heavily to like the steep loss of jobs as well. You know, if you have people at home that you need to provide care for, and you can't actually take paid leave from your job, then I imagine that's a very difficult situation to be in.
No, that's definitely, I think that's definitely important as well. And I mean, like, I think paid family leave is one of the most important issues, even in pre-pandemic times, because it just opens up so many more gateways for, you know, not having to be burdened by childcare if, you know, both partners want to have a career. But I also think, like, during the pandemic, it presents a uniquely difficult problem because, like, the whole point is you can't be around people, so you can't have, like, external out-of-the-house childcare without, like, incurring large risks. So that's just, it's a real problem. It's like, there's, I don't know what else to say other than that.
And that's like not even mentioning like the extreme cost of childcare in some cases, which can be a major burden. Plus, like I know that I was kind of looking into at the beginning of the year, like a little bit of some, and I'm still looking into a little bit of some tutoring opportunities locally because I know a lot of students are at home and they need some like extra help, whether it's online or in person. And I noticed some families like kind of requesting sort of like personal in-person tutors, and they kind of like requested that the person they would be employing would basically not have any other jobs outside the house and also would adhere to like a very strict like policy when it comes to social distancing because they have someone who is at a high risk of COVID illness at their in their house in their home. And I just thought it was very interesting because I can imagine that being a significant barrier to care as well. And not everyone has the option to personally employ someone like that. So
Yeah, no, that's really thought-provoking. Do you have any other comments about this before we wrap up?
just that I think that it's honestly a really good time for us to societally, maybe this isn't the most scientific and more of a political take, but to really look into labor laws and ordinances and how we expect people to deal with things like sick leave and family care, et cetera, especially because, you know, now that we're in a pandemic, it's like really exposed how difficult this is for people since we're all struggling with the same thing at once. But, you know, a lot of these things are also difficult for people before and after the pandemic who are in unique circumstances. And I think some of them should just be like really basic expectations for a worker in the workplace.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And I think like you said, these laws and ordinances, they don't seem very, they don't seem like they make much of a difference. But when you actually put them under observation, such as, you know, right now, they actually end up being really, really like shaping to everyday life and access. On that somewhat depressing note, we will end. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you next week.
See you next week.